Okay, so let me begin by thanking the organizers for putting together this terrific conference and for giving me the opportunity to tell you about some of the work that I've been doing. In particular, something related to what we just heard about, graphene in a periodic, in some kind of periodic potential. In this case, though, I'll be talking about effects that you get when graphene is subjected to a circularly rotating, spatially uniform electric field. And what I want to tell you about is some properties that the graphene can pick up that make it very akin to a topological insulator. So this is not working so well. Perhaps this is better. Okay. And so I'll start by introducing, sort of reminding you about ideas that have been developed over the last 6 or 7 years about graphene being a topological insulator, and then show you what happens when we subject graphene to this circulating electric field, and remind you of some things you just heard from Elsa about the Floquet spectrum, and we'll see that that Floquet spectrum is topological in nature. And then, let's see, better, okay. So we'll see things like there are edge states in the Floquet spectrum, and I'll talk about a calculation in which we see actually what kind of transport you can get through a ribbon, and which is irradiated in this way. And we'll see some interesting behavior actually from evanescent transport, which I'll try to convince you is super diffusive, and try to understand why that happens. Then I'll summarize. So my collaborators in this are Zhenghao Gu, who's a student at Indiana, and Dana Rovis at UCSD, excuse me, and Asa Auerbach at Technion. And this is our funding. Okay, so I don't need to show this audience this picture, but I will anyway. Graphene is a honeycomb lattice. You'll only see this 2 or 3 more times for the rest of the conference. So if we take this very simple Hamiltonian, which is just nearest neighbor hopping, so that would be the white bonds connecting the purple carbon atoms, then when you solve the band structure, you get this picture, which again we've seen a dozen times at least, and we get these famous Dirac points, two of which are inequivalent, the K and K prime point. And so if we look at this at low energies, we all know we get this massless Dirac Hamiltonian. The tau z here acts on the valley index so that the sign will flip depending on which valley you're looking at, and the sigma matrices act on the sublattice space. So this, of course, is a very nice and interesting system, and we've been hearing a lot about it, but people are also interested in figuring out under what circumstances you can open up a gap in this Dirac point. And this is actually something that Charlie Kane and Jean Millay looked at back in 2005, and they found a very interesting way to do this by introducing next nearest neighbor hopping, so for example along these dashed red lines. And what they realized you could do is actually have hopping that depends on which direction you go. So that if I was going from here to here, well, if I follow the nearest neighbor path and I take a right turn, they'd said, well, let's put a plus sign there. But if I follow from this dashed line over here, and so I have to take a left turn if I follow the nearest neighbor bonds, they said for such left turns, let's give it a minus sign. And so in this kind of hopping, you get a kind of circulation in these triangles defined by the bottoms having the red dashed line. So there's a kind of a time reversal symmetry breaking in what I've described to you here. But then what they notice is that if you make this sign depend on the direction of the spin, so have it have one sign for spin up and the opposite sign for spin down, then as a whole the system actually retains time reversal symmetry. And so having this kind of hopping with that spin dependence actually is allowed by the symmetries of the lattice, and so in principle actually should be there. So now if you look at this low energy, the low energy limit of this of the Hamiltonian, when you add this extra term in, then the continuum limit will have this term added to that, and you see the sigma z here tells us that we have a mass that opens up at the Dirac point, but the sign of the mass term actually depends, the sign of the mass term depends on which value you're in. So that turns out to be pretty interesting. In fact, what they found was that you actually get a non-zero churn number for the either the upper or lower band. Both of them have non-zero churn numbers when you have this kind of hopping added in. So let me just spend a couple of minutes explaining what I mean by that. And to do this, actually, I'm going to use a simple model that I believe Xucheng Zhang introduced. It's a simple 2x2 model. So we have this graphene-like hopping for the off-diagonal matrix elements, but then we have mass terms on the diagonals that depend on what k value you're at. And it's very important to get something non-trivial that the sign of these diagonal terms actually changes as k gets large. So because this is a 2x2 matrix, we can actually think of this actually as kind of a k-dependent Zeeman Hamiltonian. So this is our effective magnetic field as a function of k, and this unit n vector tells us which direction that magnetic field points in. So now if we just look at, for example, for small values of k, then we'll have just this mass term. All the other terms will go away. And so that means that the effective spinner we have will be just the nz will be different than 0, and so the spin would point up. And then as I increase k, we see that the nz gets smaller, and we begin to get this nx and ny, so that as I move around in k space, I'll begin to cover circles on this block sphere. And you see what happens as k gets larger, eventually this ak squared will cancel the mass, and so that we would cover the circle on the equator over here. And then very importantly, when k gets yet larger, eventually the diagonal will again dominate everything. But now the direction of the nz will be opposite from where we started. And so the nz will eventually point downward. And so what you get basically is that this n vector actually covers the unit sphere exactly once. So that's the situation where we have a Chern number that's either plus or minus 1. So that makes the system very similar in a certain sense to a quantum Hall system. And so one of the things you might expect, if that's true, if we have these Chern numbers, is that you can get edge states if you have a ribbon geometry. And that's one of the things that Kane and Lay showed in their early paper, that if you actually look at that ribbon geometry, here you have your two edge states. So you'd have current carried in one direction on one edge and in the other direction at the other edge. But we do have to be careful because this is being shown for only a single spin state. If we include the other spin state, then we get currents carried in the opposite direction on the edges for the opposite spins. So the edges don't really have a charge current, but rather just a spin current. And so this leads to a spin quantum Hall effect. So that's a very interesting possible phenomenon, and it's part of what started this whole field of topological insulators. So the problem with this idea that people quickly realized was that in practice, it seems this spin orbit coupling is rather small. Though this is the number that you get from a couple of papers. This may even be a little optimistic, I'm not sure. But in any case, this 5 millikelvin is very small compared to other energy scales in graphene, in particular disorder. Even if you could get to this very low temperature, we would need much, much cleaner samples before you could see this behavior. And so it seems unlikely that we're going to see this behavior in graphene in the near future. But that doesn't mean this whole phenomenology of topological insulators is irrelevant. In particular, there was another group led by Xucheng Zhang looking at other materials. In particular, they started focusing on mercury and cadmium telluride hetero junctions. And they found in this kind of system that you could get a scale for the spin orbit coupling that's quite a bit bigger if you make the geometry just right. And then Mollenkamp and his co-workers followed up on these ideas and actually made measurements and apparently really do see this quantized spin Hall effect. So I think the take-home message from this, from what we've seen here, is that you can get very interesting behavior out of this. And I think what's interesting about it is that we seem to have some kind of quantized Hall behavior, but without a magnetic field in the system. Okay. So what I think kind of can revive this idea for graphene is, for me anyway, came from a paper a couple years ago by Oka and Aoka. And Aoki, where they looked at this problem of graphene in this circulating electric field. So I want to think they and I want to think about the limit where there's no spatial dependence to the electric field, just the time dependence. So we should think of long wavelengths like microwaves or something like that. Can then look at the spectrum of the states for this problem, but we have to be careful what we mean by spectrum. And also introduced this idea of a Floquet spectrum to us in the last talk. So I'll just flash a couple of equations here, which we saw similar equations just a few minutes ago. So if you have a Hamiltonian that's periodic in time, Then the Floquet theorem tells you something very similar to what Bloch's theorem tells you about spatially periodic potentials. The wave function can be written as a piece that is, as a product of a piece that's periodic in time, and then a phase factor. And this E sub alpha here is called the quasi-energy, and it's basically a time-independent eigenvalue for the wave function. So like in the Bloch's theorem, this E alpha can be thought of as being confined to a Brillouin zone. I'll call it the zeroth Brillouin zone when it's near zero frequency. And you can also have extended zone schemes and repeated zone schemes for the Floquet bands, just like you have for Bloch bands. So the problem that we're thinking about here, we can incorporate the electric field through a vector potential that's time dependent. The nice thing about this is, since there is no spatial dependence, momentum is still a good quantum number for the Hamiltonian. And so we can actually solve for the eigenvalues of this Floquet operator. This thing is what would give us, basically the operator we need to set to whose eigenvectors should give us zero for the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. But when we just use this periodic piece of the wave function, then we get an eigenvalue problem. So we can solve this eigenvalue problem and actually get a spectrum as a function of the Bloch momentum. So that's what Oka and Aoki did, or part of what they did. There's not a whole lot you can do analytically, but one place you can do the calculation analytically is right at k equals zero. You can show that the wave functions can be written in a form that looks like this, and then solve for the quasi-energy E alpha. And then in the limit where the amplitude of the periodic potential is small, or smaller than omega over 2, you can show them that you get a gap at k equals 0 given by this form. And so this is a nice thing. We're in some sense able to open up a gap in this Floquet spectrum of graphene. So this is a figure from their paper. It's a little bit busy, but let me just talk about the parts that are important for my discussion. So this is the Floquet spectrum that they derived, or that they computed numerically. The bluish lines are basically the original Dirac cone without the microwaves in the problem. And you can see basically that the Dirac cone is kind of fractured, just in the way that you get what happens to an energy dispersion in a periodic potential for electrons when you have a spatially periodic potential. The free electron dispersion will just sort of be fractured by the Brillouin zone boundaries. So our zone boundaries, though, here are at omega over 2 and 3 over omega 2 and so on. And you can see we get, well, the way they've drawn this is actually in a repeated zone scheme. And we get this gap opening up near k equals 0. And then there are other places where we can have crossings, but they're pretty much always our level repulsions that give us gaps near the quasi-energy of 0. Okay, so I'll come back to these extra crossings a little bit later. So they show us a picture of density of states for the Floquet states. And then there's this Berry curvature over here. So let me talk about that a little bit. Because one of the things that they did was to look at the Hall conductivity of the system. So the Hall conductivity generically will not be zero because in the presence of this circulating electric field, time reversal symmetry is broken. So there's no reason for sigma xy to be zero, and generally it won't be. And they found that, just as in the quantum Hall problem with a periodic spatial potential, they showed that the sigma xy can be written in a form that involves a Berry's curvature in terms of a vector potential, which is very similar to what you get, again, for the problem of electrons in a magnetic field and a periodic, spatially periodic potential. It's very, very similar. The only little difference here, you notice there are these double braces because these wave functions are time dependent, and so you have to actually average them over one period of the potential. So once you do that, everything else is the same. And so because we have this particular form for the sigma xy, if the occupation for the bands, oh, and I forgot to say something, you notice an important point, whoops, I'll come to that in a moment. You notice an important point. The Brillouin zone for the Floquet problem actually would have its edges over here and over here. So we actually really have only two bands in the problem, and that's very generic for this. You get only two bands in this zeroth Brillouin zone. So what they showed is that that these bands actually have a non-zero Chern number, so that you get a quantized Hall conductivity if you can completely fill one band and have another of these bands completely empty. So again, we get something very interesting. We get something like a quantized Hall effect, but we're getting it without a magnetic field. So that's that interesting physics. But the problem here, the practical problem, is this F here, this occupation factor, which I'm trying to set to either 0 or 1, depending on which band I'm in. So that might happen, for example, if we could somehow be at very low, you might imagine it could happen if we're at very low temperature, provided that we could think of the quasi-energies as being analogous enough to the real energies of the states, so that we could use a Fermi-Dirac distribution. That's a highly non-trivial statement, and I'll say that you can see a lot of people making this assumption in the literature. There's quite a number of papers where that simplifying idea is used. But I think generically, it's probably not correct. So let me argue why. One of the calculations that we did when we were getting started on this was to just take the type with the periodic vector potential and go ahead and compute the Floquet spectrum and the associated Chern numbers. So this is actually such a calculation for a relatively large frequency, very large compared to the, not large, but of the order of the bandwidth for graphene. Now, I want to point out that that's kind of an artificial limit, because if I do that, then this frequency is actually kind of large, and if you look at the wavelength of the light associated with that, it would be rather short. You'd be stuck with sample sizes of 100 nanometers or smaller if you want to go to such large frequencies. But we can think about it as a theoretical problem, and we'll see that it's simplifying to do so. So we'll just talk about it a little bit, but then I'm going to want to come back to the limit where omega is considerably smaller than the bandwidth. So in this simplifying limit, we can compute these quasi-energies, and that's shown over here for a path in the Brillouin zone. If you compute the average energy of the eigenstates associated with the different k values, you find that the average energies and the quasi-energies, they're in some sense fairly similar. So at this in this situation, you might think, well, maybe I can justify using Fermi-Dirac distribution for how I'm going to occupy the various states. But this doesn't persist if I go to lower frequencies. And so even just going to somewhat smaller, just half the frequency here, you can see that we get quite a change. So this is the quasi-energies, again, along the same path. You see we get some new places where we get anti-crossings, and really actually at the Brillouin zone boundaries there are also anti-crossings. And near those anti-crossings, the average energy looks totally different than the quasi-energy. And so there's really no reason to think that Fermi-Dirac is going to actually work as a good way of sort of specifying the occupations for the states. Another interesting thing about the Chern numbers, when we get these anti-crossings, it may not surprise you that the Chern number changes. And one of the things that we find is that as we make omega smaller and smaller, the Chern number will change very rapidly, and it kind of jumps all over the place. It's a little like this problem of the electron in a magnetic field and spatial periodic potential. We actually don't have any good way of sort of predicting how that Chern number will jump around, but if you do this kind of calculation, you can find out what the Chern number is going to be. Okay. So our thought was, well, since we don't have a good way of just generally saying what the occupation should be, maybe we should look at this problem in some kind of physical geometry. So what we set out to do then is look at transport in a ribbon, and I'll show you the geometry in a moment, but let me first say something about edge states, because once we introduce a ribbon and edges, since this thing has a Chern number, you expect there's going to be edge states. Now, in the standard ribbon with zigzag edges, we know that there are already edge states, and we've seen this picture in a talk previously, so that these states over here are edge states, but they don't disperse. They're basically more or less independent of energy. So the group velocity of the electrons for those edge states is basically zero, and they're not really going to carry current. So even though the states are there, they won't really participate in the transport if you're right at zero energy. So now, to modify this picture, for the case when we have microwaves, you can do the sort of standard thing where you just introduce the vector potential as a phase factor in the Hopping matrix elements. And then you take this Floquet Hamiltonian and basically expand it in some basis and look for the eigenvalues. And that gives you the quasi-energies. The way we've done it, the quasi-energies end up in an extended zone scheme. But that's not so important. You can always figure out what it looks like in the in just the zeroth Brillouin zone. So this is a picture then of the kind of result you get. I'm not showing all the bands, just some of them. for the ribbon geometry. And here we go, we have those edge states, just as we expect, and now they disperse so that they can carry current. And I just wanted to really emphasize how much this looks like the original result that Kane and Millay actually pointed out. And I mean, even they're very similar curvatures on the edge states themselves. And that's actually, I just noticed this a couple of days ago. We didn't try to adjust the parameters to make this happen. It just seems to come out naturally. So this really suggests that we should be able to get some kind of sigma xy, and in a system with edges, a system that's a ribbon, we should get some kind of transport from edge states. Okay, so we should even see the indications of this quantum Hall-like behavior even in a two-terminal geometry. All right. So one question we can ask ourselves is how robust this edge state structure is to the boundary conditions. There should be certain things that are very robust if this is determined by a Chern number. So we did another calculation in which we adopted infinite mass boundary conditions. That turns out to be nice for some of the subsequent calculations I'll tell you about, because it's a valley-preserving boundary condition. So these are what those boundary conditions are. So what we actually did was take the continuum Hamiltonian now and diagonalize that in some basis for the Floquet operator. And this would be for the K valley. And you see, again, here are those edge states. So that seems to work very nicely. They're not laid out in quite the place where we had them for the zigzag edges, but nevertheless, they're there. On the other hand, you might worry, because if this is true for each of the valleys that we have in the system, then when I look at the K prime valley, if I have another pair of edge states, then I'm going to have more edge states in this situation than I did in the ribbon with the zigzag edges. But thankfully, it doesn't work out that way. If you do the same calculation for the K prime valley, basically just changing the sign on the Kx in the Hamiltonian, you find that the edge states are absent. So the take-home message is then we do have this robustness that the number of edge states is preserved, and the number of edge states is actually preserved independent of the boundary condition you choose, but where exactly in the Brillouin zone those edge states end up will depend on what your boundary condition is. Okay. So one of the things we want to look for is edge state transport then in this ribbon geometry. But again, we have to decide on how we're going to occupy the various states. So we looked at this geometry, and this may look very similar to you to a geometry that Elsa Prada showed us a few minutes ago. I think probably because both of us were motivated by this paper over here by Torzidlo, and this was actually a group of people working with Carlo Beinacker. And in that paper, they were looking at transport through this geometry, but of course, that was without any microwaves. That was just transport when the graphene in here is undoped, so that you have some kind of evanescent transport. That led to a very famous result that the transport actually ends up being diffusive, so that you get a 1 over L drop in the conductance. So the system acts as if it has a conductivity, even though there are no impurities in the system. And that comes from evanescent transport. What we're going to do here that's different is that we'll have now these microwaves inside the scattering region over here. And we imagine we have these leads over here, which are some kind of bulk doped leads. And we'll imagine that they're heavily doped enough that you could screen out the microwaves. And so there's no time-dependent potential in the leads themselves. That's a big simplification, because if I can ignore microwaves in these green regions, then I could say, well, they'll have some thermal distribution, and I know how I'm going to be injecting the particles into the scattering region over here. And so we solve in this way the problem of what the distribution of the electrons should be. And so the key assumption here is that we assume no dissipation in the scattering region. All the dissipation is in the lead. So the electrons come in, and they just follow the quantum mechanical rules of how they go through the system, and then eventually they can't come out. And we want to find out what the current is through the system. Okay. So one thing we're going to look for then is what happens when this L is very large, because there should be some transport that survives, some current that survives even to arbitrarily large L if we have edge states, since we don't expect backscattering if the width is big enough. Okay, this is a little bit of theory about how you look at the transport in this kind of problem. And to paraphrase Marco Pollini, this is my last page of formulas, except for all the ones that follow. Okay, so the key quantity here is the transmission probability to go from some channel P in some Li to some channel Q in some Li while absorbing or emitting n, basically photons, quanta of the periodic potential. So you can write down a formula for the current out of one of the modes and one of the leads. And actually, this formula is a homework problem in Datta's little book on mesoscopics. So it's sort of nice to work through this and show it. And so maybe I won't go through all the details here, but you can basically figure out then in this form the current out of one of the leads. From that, in this particular geometry, we have something a little bit different than what we saw in Elsa Prada's talk, because I have an inversion symmetry in this geometry, and that's very helpful when we have the kind of inversion symmetry that this problem has. It turns out that there is no charge pumping. Okay, so if the reservoir for the left and the reservoir of the right are at the same chemical potential, there'll be no net current going through the system. And so we can define the conductance, which at zero temperature would look like this. How am I doing on time? 5 more minutes. Ooh. Okay, so let me show you some results. So there are some details about how... Okay. So this is some details about how we actually do the calculation. The key is doing wave function matching at the boundaries between the leads and the scattering region. The only thing you have to be careful about is that the wave function has to be matched not just at every position, but at every moment in time as well. So there's some technical details about how you do that. I guess I won't take the time to do that, to go through that. But in the end, you get a transmission amplitude to go from one channel in the left lead to another channel in the right lead, picking up or losing some number of photons, and that transmission probability then is just, as usual, the square of the amplitude. So here's the result then for the conductance that we get. It's the colored figures over here. This is just a reproduction of the result that Tor Ziedlow and his coworkers got. So in the log-log plot, you see the straight line over here indicating the 1 over L behavior, that diffusive behavior that we expect. You notice, though, that for the case with the microarrays, we also have, not exactly, but more or less a straight line. It turns out as long as the L is smaller than the width of the sample. So we're getting some kind of power law here, but that power is not 1 over L to the 1. It's some smaller power, 1 over L to some smaller power. So that's one of the challenges to understand how that happens. And then the other thing you see here is how the conductance actually levels off at large L. And so there we have the indication that we have edge states that can carry transport electrons at arbitrary large distance. So that really shows us that this looks a lot like a topological insulator. Okay. So. I'll explain this inset in a moment, but let me put that off. The thing that we want to understand then is that we have this power law behavior. It's kind of a super diffusive behavior, and we want to understand and see if we can get some handle on why that's happening. So in the last couple of minutes, I'll just describe a slightly different, simpler calculation that gives analogous behavior. So this is not actually transport, but rather, since we believe that this super diffusive behavior is actually related to evanescent transport, to simplify things, let's get rid of the edges by adopting periodic boundary conditions in the transverse direction. So basically then I'm thinking about a nanotube, at least topologically, rather than a ribbon. And what I'm going to do now is put a voltage on half of this nanotube so that I induce some extra density over on just this side, but there won't be any microwaves over here, whereas in this side we'll have basically the Fermi energy, if you will, at zero, but we will have the microwaves over here. And so this induced charge over here will then fall off in some characteristic way as you go across this junction. And the way this falls off will be very similar to the different ways that you might expect the conductance to behave if I put another lead on the other side. So for example, this would be a 1 over L behavior if I didn't have any microwaves on this side. So I'd like to see if I can get some kind of power law on the right side when I put in the microwaves. Okay. So the difference between having the microwaves and not having the microwaves, as we said, is that we can introduce a gap in the flow case spectrum when they're microwaves. But if my frequency is not too big, then I'm going to have these Brillouin zones, and I have to consider what happens when I take these higher order Brillouin zones and translate them back into the zeroth Brillouin zone. And as you can tell, there'll be some extra crossings that appear. And so that's what this picture is all about. In the small frequency limit, we get these extra really anti-crossings, these avoided crossings. And if we think about the problem in a perturbative fashion, so imagine that the microwaves have a small amplitude, then it turns out that these gaps for these avoided crossings actually get very small very rapidly as you move to higher and higher order anti-crossings. And I should also point out that many of these crossings, if we look at some reasonable numbers, something like 10 gigahertz or something like that for the frequency here, there are actually going to be thousands of these crossings, not just a small number of them. Okay, so we need some way, even in perturbation theory, to estimate the sizes of these anti-crossings. So we do that by basically defining a Green's function, and I don't have time to go through details of this. But what's important is that you define a self-energy, and then there is actually a localization length for evanescent transport for states carried through these near anti-crossings. And that localization length is nothing more than 1 over the gap that we compute. And so these gaps are important because as these gaps get small, the localization lengths get big, and so the evanescent states near these places where there are gaps can actually carry the electrons quite deeply into the irradiated region. And so we want to know something about how this gap behaves as the M gets larger and larger. So here I was going to describe with some fun animation how you might expect this to behave, but let me just flash the result. What you find is that the self-energy actually goes as a power of the amplitude of the microwaves, but then there's this M. This M is the order of the crossing. Is this M to the 2M behavior, and this denominator at large M gets very, very, very large, and that means the self-energy gets small. So this gap actually very rapidly gets very small as we go to higher and higher order anti-crossings. And so the important physics of that is then that this localization length associated with each of the anti-crossings gets very large, so the electrons are actually able to penetrate quite deeply, even at this zero eigenvalue, quite deeply into the right side of the of the structure. So finally, what you have to do then again is some wave function matching, but the simplification is that you only have to do it at one junction. When you go through that exercise, you find that this transmission probability, if I can call it that, ends up being proportional to A0 over omega to whatever order M you're looking at for the anti-crossings. And so the net result is you get sort of two competing effects. You get this this amplitude here, which is falling off as M gets very large, but then you also get this localization, which is actually getting weaker and weaker. And so the amplitude of the wave functions themselves, the fall off of the wave function themselves, gets slower and slower as you get to large M. And so this is competition. This part for large M is trying to make the delta rho smaller, the contribution to delta rho small, but this part is allowing it to become large. And so the question is, how does that competition play out? Unfortunately, we don't know how to do that sum analytically, but we can do something like a single a saddle point approximation and just look at the one value of M in the sum that contributes the most to the sum. And when you go through that exercise, you indeed find that the resulting induced density on the right-hand side is something like a power law. There are some small corrections, some logarithmic corrections, but so it's not a perfect power law, but that's actually okay because the numerical results aren't perfectly power law either. So it's just sort of similar to this power law. So that's the story. We see the take-home message for this analysis then is that this non-analytic behavior you get in this induced density and presumably in the transport as well is coming from this competition between these very long localization lengths and the fall off of the participation of each of the wave functions with the long wavelength localization lengths that you get to the higher and higher order anti-crossings. So I guess it's about time for me to stop. Let me put up my conclusions here. I guess maybe I'll just leave these here for you to read. These are the various things I said. Here's the paper where we report the results I told you about. We do have a few other results, and I'm hoping that we'll in the not too distant future, write a long paper about this. And so let me thank you for your attention.
There are, I think, a lot of people who believe that a perfect zigzag edge is not a flat band, but has dispersion due to interactions. And I'm curious if that changes your results.
No, the results, I think, should be robust, right? Because this, if we have this churn number, then we should have current carrying edge states when we introduce an edge. So, of course, the details will be different, the precise slopes and things like that. Maybe where they are in the Brillouin zone will be affected, but there should still be current carrying edge states.
I want to ask, you mentioned that when you put the microwave in, the two leads do not feel the microwave.
Mm-hmm.
But what if there's some microwave on the leads as well? How does it change the results?
So it becomes a very hard problem then to solve. Like, so the whole point of introducing the leads in that way was to have some piece, some part of the structure that was independent of time. And that way we knew basically the distribution of electrons that would be impinging on the scattering region. If we give that up, then we need to find some principle to decide what the distribution of the electrons is going to be. And it may be actually rather sensitive to, for example, the dissipation mechanisms that you have in the lead. So I think, I don't know offhand what you can say universally about that problem, but I think it's a very interesting problem. Maybe the way to start is to look at a few specific examples.
So for diabetic pumping, there is a chair number that protects pump charge against noise and disorder. For these topologically non-trivial phlogistates, are there any physical observables besides pump charge that are protected?
Well, there's this edge state transport. That's actually not pumped charge, right?
That's
only in what I just showed you. That only occurs when I have actually a bias between the source and the drain. So that's not a pumping effect. That's
so what's the observable?
The observable is actually the transport from one lead to the other that persists at very large L, very large distance between the leads.
Conductance.
DC transport, but when you have a bias, a DC bias.
So it's conductance, not
yeah.
Current.
Yeah, it's conductance, correct. That's right.
So you induce quantized conductance by driving?
Well, I think we have to be careful about saying whether it's quantized or not. Just the fact that you have a non-zero conductance is telling you that you have these edge states. You have something that that is protected from backscattering, right? To get it purely quantized, you actually need to... So we have to be careful about that. There is some... theory, actually, there's a paper by Kitagawa where they do argue that it's a quantized Hall conductance if you put extra leads in to measure, basically to measure a voltage drop,
mm-hmm.
like sort of a four probe type of measurement. And I think that's right, but you have to be a little bit careful because when you introduce the extra leads, you do in fact get charge pumping. And so you have to be careful about exactly what you mean by conductance in that situation.
But if conductance is not quantized, then what sense it is protected?
So in that case, as long as if you define the conductance correctly, I think basically what it involves is subtracting off the pumped part of the current, then that part is quantized,
mm-hmm.
and that part is protected.
Sorry, I want to ask one more question. So when you put the microwave in, how about the heating effect?
Right, so the way we've done this, we've actually solved the equations as exactly as we can inside the scattering region. So it's not so sensible to talk about heating there because basically everything is quantum coherent. But in the leads, you may get heating, and I think this is one of the practical problems, right? So even if we can talk about a time-independent distribution of electrons in the leads are going to be heated up by the microwaves, presumably. And so that limits how low a temperature you probably could get to. I don't know experimental details of what's possible, but I think that's the main problem.